Hello and welcome to another episode of the Mark Groves Podcast. Today's episode, I didn't expect to record because recently I was so caught off guard by the news that Dr. Sue Johnson has passed away.
I grew up in an English pub, which is probably the very best place that you could ever choose to learn about relationships.
And for me, it was just so fascinating to listen to this emotional music.
Attachment pins down the specific responses that shape a loving bond.
And I wanted to do a podcast episode, a special one on her and her legacy, because she had such a profound impact, not only on me, but she has on therapists, on coaches, on anyone who is interested in learning more about relationships. Her books are like seminal pieces of work. Her book, Hold Me Tight, and her book, Love Sense, they both had such a profound impact on me and really had me make sense of why I do what I do. And that's not a pun on the title, Love Sense. But recently we had Dr. Sue Johnson on the podcast, and we wanted to do an episode where we share some of the best clips from that episode in honor of her life and in honor of her legacy. I always think to myself, when people of that level of significance in terms of the impact they have on how people love when they pass, that it really is our duty to honor their legacy by really loving at our greatest capacity and really living all out and honoring the knowledge that they have left behind through their own pains, their own sufferings, their own challenges, and just their passions to want to deeply understand the human condition, human connection. And really, we all know that at the end of the day, that's what matters in our life. So it is with the deepest sadness that we say goodbye in this earth experience to Dr. Sue Johnson and really honor her legacy and the things that she's taught us. And without further ado, here's some of the favorite clips from that episode, which was so recent. So we're really blessed to have been touched by her words and her presence right before she made the transition.
I was a working class kid. So in a working class family, everybody works. You know, that's just the way it is. So I was put on a stool and given glasses to dry, which meant that I spent my whole childhood with adults, because there weren't any other kids around. I was an only child, and watching adults. Often Friday nights was my favorite because people would get paid and then they get drunk. And they were more interesting. Okay. I felt totally safe. My father was, you know, I just felt totally safe. I was never scared. So I just was able to watch all these people. And this is, of course, I didn't articulate this when I was a kid, but it became really obvious to me really fast that the information that was being conveyed in the talk was nothing really. It was the music that was being played that mattered. It was the emotional music. And, you know, the music would suddenly change, and these two men who'd been patting each other on the back and having a lovely time suddenly turned into dire enemies who were going to, you know, punch each other out. And you could see the moment that it changed, the music changed. You know, somebody said, "I don't like the way you said that." And everything would shift, and all the other people in the pub would, the whole atmosphere would shift, and you would watch this emotional music take over. And it was so compelling. My clients taught me how to work with emotion and how to do EFT and how to bring them into these, what we now call, whether we're doing individual or couple or family therapy, we don't quite know what to call them. So we call them emotional epiphanies. We call them bonding events if it's a couple. We call them identity dramas. Because when all this motion gets going and you touch people's core emotion, who they are just emerges. You know, people say things that break your heart, actually. People say things like, instead of saying, "Well, I'm a bit depressed, you know, but I'm fine," people start saying things like, "Nobody wants me." and nobody's ever going to want me. And you hear that this is the core sense of identity they live with. So yes, emotion is very powerful. So I couldn't call the therapy anything else but emotionally focused. But I think it's cost me over the years, because in the psychology, I think emotion is still the poor relative, you know, the one that nobody really wants to look at. It's better to look at cognition, help give people skills, change behavior. Trouble with skills is skills are great if you're not too distressed. But the minute you get real distressed, you can't use it. You know, I'm a good example of that. I've been married to my husband for 36 years. And, you know, I mean, he's been with me all through this journey and we adore each other. But, you know, when we get into a real fight, which we do because we're both terribly strong personalities, some part of me says, what are you doing? What are you doing? You're messing this up. Use your EFT skills. And the other part of me says, nah. You know, I'm going to kill him. Emotion is so powerful and compelling. And the point about that is all the evidence says that if you want people to really change, not just make superficial little changes, but real change that lasts over years, you have to go to the level of emotion. It doesn't matter what model of therapy you're using, you have to, because that's really where people live. I never forget the man who said to me, to her, I'm just a big disappointment. You can feel the pain in that, yes. And so often, men shut down or try to argue their partner out of emotion, which does not work. Give advice, you know, problem solve. And men do this because we're worried that they're going to do it wrong. And then their partner's going to be disappointed in them and they're going to fail and be rejected. Women, because of thousands of years of evolution and social training and customs and just maybe the way we're wired, there's evidence that women are more responsive to people's faces than men are. Women, I think, are much more sensitive to disconnection. You know, women will say things when they're in the middle of really good couple therapy and they're really into their emotion and the therapist has helped them clarify their experience. You know, women will say things like, he doesn't see me. He doesn't care about my pain. You know, he doesn't, I'm not important to him. Look, you see that expression on his face? He just shuts down and turns his head away. And this is often women's deepest fear. Nobody's going to care. You know, if I'm vulnerable, and, you know, in a way, women are more vulnerable than men. I mean, I'm a feminist, so I don't like that frame. But, you know, I think women are particularly sensitive to the idea that if I call, will someone come? And men are more like, if I fail you, if I disappoint you, will you still be there for me? Will I still matter to you? We walk into relationships with these enormous fears and then we trigger each other. It's inevitable. You suddenly realize, hey, wait a minute. I'm real vulnerable here. Wait a minute. Right? And then something happens and you're off. You know, one person's basically saying, where are you? And usually we don't do it very well when we're upset. We don't say, I'm feeling lonely. Where are you? We say things like, you're not talking to me. Why aren't you talking to me? You know, we feel more in control if we're angry. Families, you know, parents and kids do it too. My lovely son and I are brilliant at it. We can trigger each other in a second. He's actually better than me at saying, hey, mom, we're having one of those conversations. And I say, you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. We are. He says, well, do we have to? I say, no, not really. And then we just give each other a hug. We get all caught up in our own music, playing our own music, reacting defensively to the music that's coming from the other person. And a negative dance of distance and disconnection just takes us over. And then we're like, how did we get here? And we all get stuck in these dances. And ironically, it's because we're so important to each other.
What do you think the impact of technology is on this core need of, hey, when I need you, will you be there?
It's an interesting one because, of course, I can now talk to my son who lives quite close, but he's in another city, and I can Zoom him. And that's wonderful. I think it depends on how you use it. And in general, it worries me to death. Because I was sitting in a restaurant with my husband and this beautiful family came in, all dressed up for Christmas, you know, little kids, two little kids, 6 and 5, something like this, beautiful family, right, husband and wife. And I swear they looked each other in the face for maybe 3 minutes of that whole time they were there. They all had screens in front of them. They were all on their screens. And I thought, this is disastrous. I also talk somewhere in some book, I can't remember, about being in Naples and watching this enormous Italian family. All the adults were at one end and all the kids were at the other. The adult part of the family was loud and boisterous and having arguments and jokes and smacking each other on the back and right. And the other end of the table, which had about 8 kids on it, was totally silent because they were all on devices. This is bad news. And the other thing that happens is kind of a group thing that happens here. You know, you're especially in adolescence, adolescents want acceptance. So if all your friends start talking a particular way, then you want to be accepted. So you start adopting whatever it is, that attitude, that mindset, that, you know, I think it's scary. And I think we have to start looking at technology and using it well and not letting it use us. ARE, a good relationship where you're accessible and open emotionally, responsive to each other and engaged emotionally. ARE, are you there for me, is the $1 million question in relationships. Bowlby cracked that code. And when he did, he cracked the code of our most basic emotional reality. And when we have a map to that, as a therapist, when I have a map to that, you know, somebody walks into my office. We do trainings where for years, you know, I would do it. All my wonderful trainers all around the world do it. They walk into a room with a couple they've never met or an individual they've never met. And they sit down and they start working with them emotionally. How do they do that? They didn't even meet them before because they got a map. Because when this man says to me, you're a therapist, you're going to try and make me believe that I'm not a complete disgusting human being. That's what they all do. So don't bother. And I said, okay. I said, I won't, you know. And then he talks to me and I say, it makes complete sense that you see yourself that way, doesn't it? You can't see the more soft and lovely parts of you because no one ever saw them, did they? He looks at me like I've turned into a gorilla. He says, what did you say? I say it again. I'm not going to try and persuade him to change his cognitive frame. That's a waste of time. As he said, you know, he's proved that therapists can't do it. So there, you know, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to say, right, when you grew up, nobody saw you. Nobody saw the little, small, fragile, sensitive boy, the incredibly intelligent, sensitive boy who needed to be seen and held. Nobody saw that. So you know, you sort of shut that part down and you've lived basically your life until now alone. Now, when your partner comes and wants to be close, you don't know how to do that one. You know, you actually get mad at her because, you know, she's inviting you to be in touch with emotions that you don't want to be in touch with. And this gentleman was a delightful client. He kept asking me if I'd read existential philosophers as an out. So I got fed up at one point and said, look, I've read them all, okay? And I particularly dislike Heidegger, okay? And you like Heidegger. So let's get back to what we're really talking about. What did you say 5 minutes ago? You said, you know, and I go for an emotional statement, you know, but when you have a map to who we are, and how we need to connect with others and how that dance goes with self and other, then you can go in really fast and very efficiently and meet people where they are.
The majority of us, we need resources, and you offer a really tremendous resource. Your book, Love Sense, as well, is tremendous. So it's like, Hold Me Tight was the, someone recommended it to me and I started reading it. I was like, this is such a great, it makes everything make sense. So for you listening, go pick up a copy of Hold Me Tight. If you feel called, it sounds like there's probably a program that's accessible no matter what, where, and how. We'll make sure that we put all the links to your books, your work, the new book that you have coming out that's for everybody. Dr. Sue Johnson, thanks for your willingness to be courageous to push against what was a traditional grain in psychology, because I know through your work, you've facilitated a lot of connection and a lot of connection to self, that in my perspective, perfecting that skill, the pursuit of that, is actually what will change the world. So I really just want to say thank you for everything you've done for me, but for the people of the world relationally. So thank you.
Oh, that's a lovely thing to say, Mark. That's a lovely Christmas present. Thank you. And I hope so. Me and my wonderful EFT colleagues, we're a passionate lot, and I hope we've made a difference. I hope we have.
You absolutely have. So thanks so much for your time today.
You're really welcome.
Appreciate it.
It's been incredible fun, actually.